You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Telling you, bro, what's been happening, bro?
Not too much.
Still hitting more Peggy-O's.
Hi, this is Shane Terrio. And you are listening to The Riff Raff, stories and insights from the front line. Hey everybody, welcome back to the show. I really, really appreciate all the kind words on iTunes and my website. Thanks so much. Definitely the comments and the reviews help this thing move up the charts. My guest today is Mr. Avi Bortnik, great guitar player, great guy. You know, in a world filled with shredding guitar players, which I love, and you know, nine-year-old girls playing Eruption on YouTube, it's really refreshing to hear a guitar player like Avi that can make a crowd get up and dance with just a simple but effectively placed part. Although Avi's probably best known for being a crucial member of John Scofield's innovative Uber Jam Band, he's also got his own projects going on, Shitty Shitty Jam Band, which is the greatest title ever, which we're listening to now, and Avi B3. He's got his solo record Clean Slate, which we'll play some things from. And he also designs apps for guitar. One of them is called the Time Guru. And he's also got an Echo Pitch multi-shifter. I'm going to link to this stuff on my site. But really innovative player, comes up with great sounds, and we're going to chat about all this stuff. So follow me. I'm in Chinatown, New York City, walking to Avi's building. Show up, plug into a Fender Princeton, and Avi's got his stuff going, and here we go. Hope you enjoy. Thank you. Yeah, man.
Yeah.
She called that Chinatown Jam.
Yeah, that's actually based off a little funk groove from this band that was from the 70s called the Propositions or the Prepositions.
Oh, yeah.
They changed their name, but they were like 17 from somewhere in Michigan. Just amazingly funky.
Wow. Well, I want to get into all that. Let me back up. All right. I'm sitting in New York City, Chinatown, Avi Bortnick, my guest today. Yeah, man. Thanks for having me over to your pad.
Oh, man. My pleasure, nice place. Shane. You're not only a great buddy, but just I'm a big, huge fan of your guitar playing.
Oh, man.
Playing.
Please. Thank you,
yeah,
man.
It's an honor.
Well, likewise.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, I don't normally get into, like, I don't want to alienate the guitar players on my podcast usually, but we don't usually discuss gear and things. Mm-hmm. Not that I'm opposed to it. I just never do it. But you're one of my few buddies that we text each other pedal pictures.
Yeah, right.
I think my only friend like that, you know. And
I think I texted you my tiny 6-inch pedal board, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So well, Sko's got
New York
that,
style.
Right?
Yeah. Sko sort of inspired that. I had been thinking about that for a long time, but I also had this short, relatively low-budget tour in Canada, and there was no room to bring a road case with gear. So I made this tiny little pedal board that had these, you know, miniature pedals on them. And it worked out pretty well. It was fine. It was
I think minimalism is the new trend with guitar pedals. But yeah, actually, Sko had asked me about these. He said, do you ever see these little pedals? And I've never used them, but a friend of mine named Eric Struthers in New Orleans had a connection with them. So he, I guess he hooked up Sko with some stuff. I guess he likes them now.
Yeah.
Man, I think that we don't generally have topics. I have a few things, but man, you're all about rhythm guitar, and there's not many people that are as badass rhythm accomplished known for, you know, just rhythm guitar. There's not a lot of cats, man. So maybe we could talk about that,
sure.
You know, I mean, and I want to hear about your, I don't know anything about your early influences.
Yeah.
You know?
Sure. It goes pretty far back at this point. Well, I was raised in St. Louis and, came up in the mid to late 70s, really, is when I started getting serious about guitar. And the area of St. Louis where I grew up was pretty integrated. So a lot of the bands were just funk bands, you know, with black kids in them. And that was just kind of the way you played guitar. You played rhythm guitar in this funky way, if you want to call it that. I mean, there was rock too, but a lot of the influences were just kids I watched, like other people or grown-ups even, you know, oh, that's the way you play guitar. And that's, you know, and then I would get in these bands where you have to play in that style. So as far as influence, it was kind of all the 70s pop and funk people. Nile Rodgers was a big one, Al McKay and Earth, Wind & Fire. And then kind of, I don't know, people whose names I didn't really know. I knew the tunes and the group, but I didn't know who was playing guitar. It was just kind of incidental. Oh, yeah, it's maybe Roger with Zap, I guess. Mm-hmm. But, you know, whoever played guitar in Cameo and...
Charlie, you know, something, was it?
Ring My Bell, what was her name? You know, all those songs just had these, like, kind of, usually kind of... just on the top three strings, played high, that kind of funk. You know, it wasn't really like greasy funk, I guess.
Right.
It was more like the guitar had this role in the very top end of a lot of the tunes. But it was all very either forward in the mix. I mean, you could really hear it, especially Nile Rodgers' stuff.
Yeah,
you know?
Man.
So he was a big influence. And back then, everyone thought Nile Rodgers was kind of the best rhythm guitar player, or the most, I think it was just more prominent in the mix, so you could really hear him.
And it was the records he played on too at the time. I mean,
great tunes and everything. So, but you know, I took lessons. I mean, most of the time I don't practice rhythm guitar, and kind of I've probably spent 10 or 20% of my time practicing rhythm guitar, you know, and timing and chords and all that. The rest of the time I'm working on the stuff that everyone else is working on, scales and trying to solo better and play over changes, you know, with varying degrees of success. But somehow rhythm just always came a little easier. So it was kind of, I just knew what that felt like in your body and in your arms. and your fingers. And that was just easy. And then when I moved to California in my late teens, I guess I was 19, after I went to UC Berkeley, not the music school Berkeley, and I didn't study music, I studied Latin American studies. But soon after graduating, I started playing in a lot of Caribbean and African bands. And there again, it was like all rhythm guitar. So most of the gigs I found myself in, 95% of the time, I'm playing rhythm guitar. And then, so probably a lot of that just comes from spending time gigging, playing rhythm, rather than working on it at home.
Yeah, that's the best way to learn. Yeah. So, you know, I think that's the best way to learn, man, is on the gig, you know, real world.
Yeah, I think that has advantages and disadvantages, that sometimes you're just strengthening things you know a little bit and not pushing yourself. I think it has to be, or to learning new tricks, because you're too afraid that the new idea you have on the gig isn't going to work or something like that. I don't know, it's right. A mix. There's definitely things that came out of playing gigs, I know, but maybe it's also because, you know, you can't get too fancy playing rhythm guitar. So it's a little bit like being a bass player, you know. You can get all these chops and play a six string and do all kinds of fancy stuff. But in normal music, very few people want to hear that. Mm-hmm. So it becomes this thing just for bass players. And it's a little bit like that with rhythm guitar. Yeah, you can get some crazy stuff going, but in an actual tune, you don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with the Sco band, Sco gives me spotlighty kind of moments where I get to do stuff I wouldn't normally do in a tune. It's mm-hmm. just more like, wanking off in a sense, just doing busy, trickier kind of things that mm-hmm. I wouldn't play while other people are playing. It's just like I have to fill up the space and do something that seems novel or impressive.
Sure.
You know.
You know who Buzz Featon is?
I know he's got the tuning system, yeah, and he's a guitar player, but I don't know him.
He was a great session player in the 70s and 80s. Yeah. I guess he had Featon Larson, but man, there's some stuff with him playing like Olivia Newton-John with like Mike Landau. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, he did a lot of stuff, but he's a great rhythm guitar player, and I don't really know him personally, but I met him at a NAMM show once, and he actually came, he thanked me. He goes, man, thank you for playing rhythm guitar.
Oh, wow.
Nobody does this anymore.
Yeah.
And I'm just trying to keep my gig. It's not a conscious choice.
You know, I think part of it is just changes in black music. And first of all, they're really, if you think about it, there's no black bands like there used to be, except for maybe the Roots, but they've been around for a while. But
they're sort of retro anyway. Yeah. Retro anyway.
Right. But that culture of bands in the black community doesn't really exist, except for maybe in the gospel world.
Mm-hmm.
But that was, to me, like the source of rhythm guitar. Sure, there was rock rhythm guitar, but that was a little bit of a different thing. I mean, mm-hmm. you still had to play in the pocket, but it mm-hmm. wasn't like that driving thing.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, in your podcast with Jude, you said something that I thought was accurate. You said something like the guitar can be like tambourine with notes.
Well, that's Nashville. The acoustic is basically it's an alternate form of you know, a shaker.
Yeah,
it's just sort of there, you know, and so,
which I don't mind doing. If you're in the pocket and playing the guitar shaker, then it feels good to me.
Yeah.
So
yeah, well, you know, there's and I'm sure we'll weave in and out of rhythm guitar throughout this whole interview. But what's another thing about you, Avi, is that, let's see, you have a lot of friends from the West Coast,
mm-hmm.
and it seems, I don't know all the history about it, but it seems like there was some exodus from the Bay Area at some point.
Yeah.
Because you ended up in the Bay Area.
Right. But I ended up in the Bay Area not of my own volition. It's that my dad got a job transfer. I spent a year at the University of Wisconsin, and then he got a job transfer. Going from St. Louis to San Francisco, and I was pretty directionless, and it seemed like a really great thing to move to San Francisco. So I took a year off, moved out there with my family, worked in a warehouse, and then applied to UC Berkeley and got in and continued my undergraduate degree. So I'm not from the Bay Area, but you're right, I know a lot of the people, and it's true, there was kind of an exodus. I think what happened was a couple of things working in tandem. One is that it was a great place to be a musician in the 80s, particularly late 80s through mid 90s. There were a lot of gigs. You could actually just go around playing different clubs and actually make a living. And you didn't have to do many weddings or teach or do it. You know, you could just go from club to club. So it was great. And there were a lot of really good musicians. And it was kind of an instrumental, funky kind of music that was dominating. So it was great for musicians who wanted to solo and write instrumental tunes. But then that sort of started to dry up. But in the meantime, you had all these guys who were really good. And then, you know, New York was always the mecca for musicians, especially jazz-oriented musicians. So a lot of them started coming here. Then you get a few here, and then now there's contacts and people you can either stay with initially or play with, you know, and they would report back, yeah, it's great, we're playing a lot. And so then, you know, that it spirals. I didn't really move out here because of that. I came out because I started playing with Sco.
Another question. Was it post or pre Uber Jam you moved to New York? Well, that's a good reason to come.
It was
kind of have a gig.
It was really kind of the last year of Uber Jam that I moved out. For the first few years, I was commuting back and forth. Mm. So I was mostly living out there, but I was spending a lot of time here, probably a little bit like you, mm-hmm. you know. So I was spending a lot of time here, and then it just made more sense to be here, mm-hmm. both logistically for the traveling, and also I was developing more friends, and it felt like I had more of a community here. And I liked the social scene, and not driving, not sitting in Bay Area traffic, so it just kind of made sense to mm-hmm. move here.
You were craving snow.
Yeah. Well, I grew up with snow, so it wasn't...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, St. Louis has four seasons. It gets really, really hot in the summer, but it also gets pretty cold in the winter. So, you know, I used to play hockey and ice skate on the ponds and everything.
Well, let's talk about how did you land the gig with Sco? I never asked you that. I know it was some West Coast connection, I think.
Yeah, Sco had done this record Bump in that came out either in the end of 1999 or early 2000, I forget. And he had done some guitar overdubs, and he was looking for someone to do a short tour with who could just play those parts, you know. So it wasn't like a big feature role for guitar or anything, but he wanted someone to, and he had never done a two guitar band, I don't think. He always had a keyboard player or trio, so I think he thought it'd be an interesting concept to have two guitars. But he got my name. He was asking around, like, do you know someone who plays good rhythm guitar and doesn't mind not soloing?
Right.
You know? And so he got my name mostly from Charlie Hunter, mm-hmm. who is someone I knew from the Bay Area. Charlie was already out here, but Charlie knew my playing a little bit. And I think he also heard my name from a couple of other sources. Lee Townsend, this producer who...
Didn't he do Nora Jones?
I don't think he did.
He produced the Bill Frisell record.
Bill Frisell. I think he's Bill Frisell's manager. Maybe.
Okay, that's what it
too.
Is. Yeah.
And but he produced the Bump record for Sco, actually. Really nice guy. And then Sco may have heard my name in a roundabout way through Jesse Murphy, who was her.
Yeah, man, I love his playing, man. I love Jesse. Yeah, I love Jesse. I'm a huge Brazilian Girls fan.
Me too. And Jesse's. Yeah, I can't say enough about his bass playing.
Is he playing with you tonight?
No, he's not. We still play together, but Jesse lives upstate, so it's become more rare. But Jesse's bass playing is so different and kind of uncliched to me. And Jesse's funny. He's like one of the few guys who will start a groove, and if he starts it on his own, I don't know where one is. You know, most people have absorbed all the vocabulary, and so you just hear.
Yeah.
But with Jesse, it's like, what is going on there?
Right.
But it's so cool and inventive, and he's got a great sound and a great guy too.
Well, he was another Bay Area guy that came too.
Yeah, he was actually from Santa Cruz, just south of the Bay Area.
Well,
but kind
West
of
Coast.
Yeah. But Kenny Wallison, this drummer, and mm-hmm. Man, there's so many people out here.
Adam Levy.
Adam Levy.
Oh, he's back in
LA. Adam Levy kind of moved around. He was, I think, I don't know if he came from Boston.
The first time I actually met you was with Adam. Actually, it was in New Orleans, and we went to Tipitina's. You were playing with Sco.
Oh, okay.
And we were backstage. Yeah. I think I got your record or something that night.
Liberty Elman, another great guitar player from the Bay Area, is out here. Do you know Liberty?
I don't know.
Liberty's great.
Yeah, I'd like to check
him out.
Really
happening. He does a lot of the more avant-garde kind of jazz stuff. Henry Threadgill. He's been with him for a long time. But Liberty's, he's funky and just rhythmically solid and really just super interesting player.
I guess a lot of guitar players would know, what's it like to play guitar next to John Scofield, you know, but you're such a strong presence. You have your own thing going on. If anybody's ever seen Uber Jam, I mean, it's like your whole thing, man. You've got your laptop and those sounds, and it's almost like you're a very strong voice in that band. It's not like you're just, maybe it started out where you were playing little miscellaneous parts, but it's not the case anymore.
Yeah.
But anyway, what is it like to play with Sco? You know, I've played with him, but not on stage.
Yeah. Well, I mean, first of all, John's a great guy, as you know. Mm-hmm. He's hilarious and self-effacing and, of course, just a brilliant pace-setting guitar player. I mean, so in that sense, it's a huge privilege and honor that I get to play with him. But at first, I was really pretty nervous, as you can imagine. When I was playing parts together with him, we had some, you know, melodies that we'd play together. He would watch my hands. I don't even know if he was aware of this, but man, that made me nervous. I think he was just curious how I was fingering things or maybe trying to play, you know, in sync with me. But yeah, I felt like I wanted to have a curtain so he couldn't see me. So it made me nervous, but you know, he was always super supportive and had kind words and also kind of just gave me tons of freedom to do whatever I thought was appropriate. On a few occasions, you know, he'd steer me in one direction or another or show me chord voicings that maybe he thought would be cool to play while he's soloing or something like that. But for the most part, he just kind of lets me be. And he does that with all musicians in his band. I think John likes... I don't think he likes to tell people how to play or what to play too much. He just likes working with people who bring something that inspires him or that he finds cool. And John is also very sensitive to rhythm, so he really likes rhythmic kind of music, you know.
Yeah.
And I love John's rhythm playing, too, because he plays with his thumb, and it's got this cool looseness to it. It's like... it's almost like he's playing with a giant rubber pick or something.
Yeah. You know,
it's like it's a lot of strings at once, but it's kind of clunky, but I love it. It's,
you know, backing up to what you said about, he just lets you kind of do whatever. It's first of all, obviously you trust your instincts cause you're a great player, but I find that to be, as I interview people like that are working with quote, you know, notable or whatever the word is, I don't know, great musicians, that's a common theme, a continuous thing that comes up is like, well, they don't really tell me, you know. John Harrington said the same thing. Donald Fagen's like, yeah, they just kind of let me do.
Yeah.
And Daryl and John let me do, you know, I think that great artists, no, they just hire somebody that they think they trust and they go, okay, well, I hired you for Avi, you know, I want you to put your thing into it.
Yeah. And maybe there's an element of, they know that the musicians in the band really look up to them and are always maybe slightly nervous, you know, about not screwing up and playing well. And they know that if they start telling you stuff too much, then it becomes a downward spiral where you become too self-conscious, and then you're not playing, and then you're thinking you're sucking the whole time. And so it's, if you've got that sort of power, you don't want to use it in a way that makes people play worse.
Right.
So.
You know, I don't normally do this on the podcast, but since you've got all your cool pedals set up, maybe you, is there any, I don't know, anything you want to demonstrate or show me something new?
Sure. I mean, well, this pedal board is the pedal board that I use with the SCO band. It's not what I take around in New York. It's too big. But
what
it's
is
basically
that? It looks like some kind of blackboard or something. Where'd you get thing? That? Yeah, where'd you get the board?
Well, first of all, this pedal board is kind of two different things. It's normal guitar pedals. As you can tell, there's a bunch of Boss pedals on it, and a wah-wah and all the normal stuff. But there's also tucked under here a computer interface.
Oh, yeah, I see it.
So what happens is, well, two things. This thing that you call the blackboard, it's a Macmillan 12-step, and it's just a MIDI controller. It's kind of like a keyboard, so C, C-sharp, D, D-sharp, etc. It's one octave. But it just sends MIDI notes, so that's tied in with the laptop. So if I hit one of these MIDI notes, it triggers something in the laptop.
I see.
It can either be a sound, a beat, a guitar effect, whatever. So this bypass looper kicks in the laptop. In other words, it routes a guitar through the computer interface, through the laptop, and then back out into the amp. So that way I can use laptop-based effects in a live guitar-based setting. Mm. And the cool thing about it is if you're savvy or experimental with laptop sounds, you can get all these things going that you can't find in a pedal. So it goes way beyond chorus or distortion or delay. And you can get all these trippy pitch shifting effects and sequence patterns. You can trigger other sounds.
Do you have any of that stuff hooked up right
yeah,
now?
Yeah, yeah, I could.
Yeah, could you just demonstrate a few things?
Oh, and I'm also using this. So I'm using two programs on the laptop. One is Ableton Live, which a lot of people know about. And then the other is this really cool program called MIDI Guitar, which is, it takes your guitar notes and turns them into MIDI notes. And it's polyphonic, so you don't need a special guitar pickup, MIDI pickup.
I see.
So you can play synth sounds and other MIDI-based, well, MIDI effects, if you want to trigger MIDI effects with notes, but mostly synth sounds with your whatever guitar is plugged in, so you don't need to switch, you know, this cumbersome MIDI pickup.
Yeah, gotcha.
It's very
yeah.
cool. And it tracks really well, too. So I've got two programs running in tandem, like I said, MIDI Guitar and Ableton Live. And this is a song where there's a beat going, and it's kind of a drum feature. So the drummer is playing over this beat, and I can do... This controller here just is for the laptop, and you know it's, I can trigger different effects for the loop. Mm. But then if I play guitar, like here's the normal guitar sound. Then
yeah, that sounds great.
So that's a synth sound that's being kind of chopped up into this rhythmic pattern. So while that's going on, you know, I might be doing something with that, but then I can switch to this sound. So that's, I'm basically playing one note, and this pitch shifter is pitch shifting that note in a pattern. That's not MIDI, that's just a plug-in.
Oh, I see. So, oh. Oh, that's nice.
And then I also have it set up so I can loop stuff if I want.
Yeah, man, that's great.
So that's what I'm talking about, where you can use the laptop to make effects that you can't really find in a pedal, at least to my knowledge. And they can be very personal effects, rather than, oh, here's my Univibe or my Auto Wah. And, you know, it's funny. I was thinking about it, about guitar effects and how, you know, in the 60s, I guess the novel effect was fuzz, maybe overdrive. Then 70s, it was wah. And then 80s had chorus and delay. And late 90s or early 2000s, it was kind of the whammy pedal. But since then, I can't think of any widely used guitar effects. Everyone's using basically the same things. And you can see, I've got a fuzz, an overdrive, a wah, a reverb, a phase shifter, a chorus, a delay, and then this Eventide H9, which just goes between tremolo or univibe or some sort of setting like that.
I think we've arrived at the point as guitar effects. It's the same as like a Fender Rhodes and a Whirly, you know, it's like classic. So everybody's always going to have a tube screamer or some derivative or something like that, and a wah-wah pedal.
Yeah.
And, you know what I mean? It just kind of never goes out of style. But you're right. I mean, nobody's doing anything near what you just demonstrated, to my knowledge. Maybe there are people.
I think there are some bands, like, but maybe they're not known as being guitar-centric bands. Mm-hmm. But there's people, sometimes maybe people who aren't real super skilled guitar players in a traditional sense, but are inventive with effects. Battles. Those guys might be great guitar players. I don't know. But if you go hear them live, the guitar stuff they're doing is very heavily affected, but in very novel ways. I love those guys. They're amazing. So there is some creative guitar going on. And then, do you know Michael Ross, this guitar player? He writes for Guitar Player sometimes. He's kind of been on the guitar magazine scene, but he also has a cool web magazine called Guitar Modern.
Hmm.
And he'll feature people who are doing really unusual stuff. So there are people out there, but I don't. It hasn't gotten absorbed into rock and pop music that a lot of people know. It sort of stays on the fringes. Yeah, it's an interesting thing to contemplate. I mean, maybe all the easy things that are just kind of processing that don't completely mangle the guitar have already been developed. And in a sense, it's all filter or delay-based processing, if you think about it.
Right.
You know, so maybe there's only so much you can do, and everything's a variation on a theme at this point. But the laptop opens up all kinds of possibilities. There's another tune that we do with the Sco Band. It's called I Break for Monster Booty. And, and in that, I'm doing this funny thing where a rap going, and it's silent because there's a gate in front of it. And the gate is side-chained to my guitar. So when I play guitar, you hear the rap. So I can sort of rhythmically chop up the rap. I'll show you what I mean. So this is the normal beat, right? And it's the guitar. But
oh, yeah. Now, Avi's right hand is actually triggering those rap lines.
Right.
So when he's strumming, you can't see it, but...
And then I can do this, too. Whoops. Oh, sorry, wrong one. Here we go.
A funky clap. Yeah.
So clav loop that's going, and there's a gate in front of it that's side-chained to the guitar input. So I'm determining when the clav plays in a rhythmic sense, but not in a note sense, if you know what I mean.
How did you figure all this stuff out?
Well, that was actually, I lifted that idea. I was reading this article about recording a Chic track. I forget which one it is, but it has a piano or a clav solo in it. And I was reading that whoever they had come in sort of wasn't really in the pocket or something. They were trying to play solo. It just wasn't happening. So the engineer said, just play chords, like just hold a chord down, you know, and switch at every bar or something like that. And then what they did is exactly this. They put a gate in front of it. Of course, this was all in the analog days, but you could still do the same thing. They put a gate in front of it and sidechained the gate to Nile Rodgers' guitar. So Nile Rodgers actually plays the rhythmic portion of what you hear, even though it's a clap. Mm. I thought, wow, that's really cool. I could do that with a computer easily. So, you know, but that's where I got the idea. And I've spent a long time messing with Ableton Live. It's probably 15 years. And, you know, you just start learning possibilities. And then also online user forums are really helpful. And yeah. We also had this sound guy for a while, sound guy and road manager, Ben Sermon, who still works with SCO sometimes. But he was really savvy with Live. So like that pitching thing, mm-hmm. He actually hit me to this plugin, the pitch shifting plugin that responds to MIDI. So he showed me that thing. And so I've picked up different ideas from people. Wow. And then sometimes you just have an idea. It's like, wow, I wonder if maybe I can do the same thing but trigger a drum beat, or maybe I can play a note that'll set off an effect. Yeah, maybe I can. Like the pitch shifting thing is like, wow, I wonder if I could play a note but have it randomly pitch shifted but stay in a key. Like tell it to randomly, sort of like random soloing.
Yeah.
And it sounds random. It doesn't make much sense, but it is in the key. So it's technically all right. And then sometimes it comes up with cool patterns. But that was a little too much, the randomness. Actually, I have it set up so that if I hit one of the buttons on my pedal board, it scrambles it into random, so I can kick it in and out of random. But otherwise, it stays in a pattern, in a key. So it always works.
Did I ever tell you about this pedal I have called a... I should look it up, because it's called a Peftronix or something, randomizer. It's supposed to be a super rare pedal. I have one, like mint condition. And evidently, they're really hard to find. They're like $800 on Reverb.
And what does it do? Scrambles the pitch?
Yeah, and it's like sort of a flanger, but it's got this random thing to it. And it sounds... I think Vernon Reed bought one, and people were looking for them. I could never find a use for it. And the whole circuit is like, it's got epoxy over it, so you can't...
Oh, yeah,
and
wow.
All the capacitors, they're all scratched, the values, so you can't ever copy it.
There's a pedal that kind of does somewhat similar things, but it's not very flexible. I think it's only presets, and you can't really alter things very much. But it's the Boss Slicer pedal.
Oh yeah, sure. I've used one of those before on a session.
You know, so that'll do these semi-arpeggiated,
stuttery
arpeggiated things. So but the laptop is better if you don't mind having a laptop on stage and an interface, because you can just customize it completely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, what you're doing, man, is a whole couple, three, four levels up from... Yeah. You know, you remember you had that DOD wah pedal?
Mm-hmm.
I remember hearing this story about... I've never seen anybody ever use one of those except my neighbor when I was going to school in California. This German guy had one. It was a DOD wah.
Yeah, volume. I still have that, yeah.
And I remember reading this or seeing this interview with Bill Frisell, where he did this guitar clinic, and all these people were asking him, you know, I guess it was in Europe somewhere, they're like, does it have a special pot, or why do you use this volume pedal, and is it the capacitance? And he looked at him real, he's totally confused, and he goes, well, this one fits in my guitar case.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And sometimes
there's no mystery to it.
Yeah, it's what you get comfortable using, and sometimes you're just not exposed to anything else. So like the DOD wah, I think what happened is, you know, I had a crybaby and it seemed like the pot was always crapping out. It's like, screw that. And, you know, this DOD was had an optical thing that just never went bad. So I got it and I just started using it. I don't mm-hmm. know. And then I got used to kicking it on in the heel position, which I wish more WA manufacturers would make. That makes more sense to me rather than in the ice picky area mm-hmm. where you have to start your WA. I do a lot of stuff. It's getting a little old to me, but I do a lot of stuff where I use dotted eighth delays, and just for convenience, I will use the laptop for that. So, like, but if I want, I can also pitch it up. So it's doing a fourth, I think.
Yeah. Sounds like King Crimson or something. Yeah, man, that was fun. So, should have kept going. It's like King Crimson or something.
Yeah, right. So, you know, I've heard other guitar players use that dotted eight thing, and that, you know, if you add an extra interval and all of a sudden becomes something that mm-hmm. someone else hasn't done, maybe, mm-hmm. hopefully. I have a feeling there's a lot of other people out there who are really experimenting with
probably so.
With laptops totally... and iPads and all these things. There aren't really great ways to use it live, you know, because you have to plug in your USB cable and your interface. And I wish someone would just make a pedal that was an interface. You know, actually, there is something similar. It's a iRig Stomp where you can use an iPad, but it has an analog interface that uses, or an analog connection that uses the headphone jack of your iPhone, and that tends to be kind of noisy. So it's not really made for anyone who's serious about using it in their rig.
Yeah, it's taking kinda, it on a European
it's
tour.
It's kind of a toy. Yeah, it's right. A little bit too much. So I think there's room for hardware for guitar players to be able to use this stuff live in a more convenient way without having to connect all these different cables and worry about crashing and all this stuff.
Yeah.
And that is one of the drawbacks about using a computer. Occasionally, weird stuff happens, sometimes inexplicable. Something drops out, something stops.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, have you ever had a disastrous moment on stage where like you had to start a tune over again, like with SCO or something?
Yeah, one time the sample rate was wrong, and so the tempo of the loops were wrong. I was like, what is going on?
Have you ever seen that Van Halen video on YouTube, Jump?
Yeah.
And it's off just enough.
Right. It's like the difference between probably 44.1 and 48.
But that's it. That's disastrous in an arena. And Eddie Van Halen is trying to, like using his fine tuners on his Floyd Rose, the whole tune. It's like, it doesn't sound right.
Yeah. I've
and when he that. Gets, when he gets to the solo, man, it is, it's excruciatingly out of tune. It's so bad. Yeah. Somebody got fired that night.
Yeah. Yeah, of course. It's happened occasionally, not as much as it used to. Like there are times when things just kind of died on stage. The good thing is, really, the John Scofield Band, we don't really need any of this stuff. We can just play, and it sounds great, mm-hmm. you know? So, but it adds another dimension. Like, it thickens up the beats, or it adds, you know, these wacky effects, or other sounds that I can bring in. So, it's helpful, but if I think all of our tunes... If this completely goes away, we can still play it. So mm-hmm. it's not exactly like Van Halen or something where you're completely dependent
right,
on some, you know, that keyboard part or something. And also we're a band where it's not like hit songs that everyone knows if something is missing. <you know?
laughs> It's jazz. Yeah. He meant to do that. What about you know, one of my favorite tunes, man, is Lucky for Her.
Oh, wow.
I love that tune. I don't know what it is. It's the last tune on the first Uber Jam record, I think.
Yeah.
And man, the your rhythm guitar part when it breaks down and the bass line, it's simple, but
yeah.
Wow, that is a super funky track.
Yeah, I think that was kind of a sound check jam. You know, really? One of those tunes that just came out of, I think I had this sample. At the time I was using a Boss Doctor sample, one of those things with the 8 pads on it, which are fantastic devices in some ways. The built-in effects on it are fantastic, and it's just really easy to use and didn't make you nervous like a computer can make you nervous.
Yeah.
And everything's right there. So it was it's a dedicated hardware sample player. And so I had this sample, which I don't even know where I got it or where it came from. I didn't make it. I don't know. I found it, then I chopped it up and put it back in this. That's what happened. So it wasn't someone else's sample completely. I dealt with it in some way and changed it. But that was based off that sample that starts the tune originally. And then the rhythm guitar stuff, I think, if I remember, it's just me using a ring modulator where I'm moving the frequency with it's that electroharmonics frequency analyzer, and I put a bigger knob on it so I could move it with my foot. That's basically, I'm twisting it around. I think that's the tune where I'm doing that.
Yeah, I love that track.
Yeah, it's a cool track. It's and that's Go's melody. I don't know where that came from, but
great cover too, that Uber Jam cover.
Yeah, it's funny, right?
The first one where he's like the what is it, the Hindu kind of god or whatever. And
well, you've probably seen it if you've been to
Sko's
house.
It's hanging in his living room,
big,
in the kitchen, in the dining.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah, I love it. I'd always go stare at it.
Yeah.
You know what? Tell me about Shitty Shitty Jam Band, which is the greatest title ever, I think.
Yeah, that's a band where the core of it is Jesse Murphy, Aaron Johnston, who both play in the Brazilian Girls you mentioned, and me. Years ago, we had Sean Pelton playing too.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
wow.
And this really great keyboard player, Brian Charette. So we used to play every Tuesday at New Blue, and Jesse came up with that name. It was almost like one of those situations where the name came first and the band after, just because we wanted to have a band where we could call it that.
It's like that somebody had a name of a band called JFKFC, which you know they came up with that first.
Right.
They had to have.
So, and the interesting thing is some of the Sko tunes that are on records now started off as Shitty Jam Band jams, where I came up with some groove.
Not literally shitty, just yeah.
Yeah, right. Well, some nights we lived up to the name. There's some videos of us playing and some recordings also. Yeah, so we were just playing at New Blue pretty often, and Jesse I knew from the John Scofield band, and Aaron I actually knew from the Bay Area. Aaron's a great drummer and one of the few guys who plays convincing Afrobeat. I love Afrobeat, mm-hmm. and the fella legacy stuff. And Fella's drummer was kind of this singular character named Tony Allen, mm-hmm. who's around. I think he lives in England and plays a lot still. But he basically, to my knowledge, invented this drumming style that came to be known as Afrobeat. And it's funky in a different way. It's not backbeat-oriented funk. And it's actually, he plays really light. It's really interesting to watch him. You can find videos. He's almost like a jazz drummer playing this weird funky beat. And it's got a slight swing to it. But to me, Aaron is one of the few guys who has the proper amount of swing and has incorporated a lot of the Afrobeat stuff. So some of the Shitty Jam tunes that later became Sko tunes have this Afrobeat backing, like
interesting
that tune.
Yeah, yeah, I've heard you guys do that
one. And then what, there's a couple of others that have an Afrobeat groove. Anyway, those were Shitty Jam Band songs that we used to play, and then some of them Sko either put a different bridge on it or changed the melody. So those tunes are collaborative, but usually the process for those collaborative tunes is it started off with me sending him these grooves or jams that I was already playing, and then he went through them and decided which ones he thought were cool and adapted them, and then we started doing it with Uberdune. Yeah, but if you go online, you'll hear some of the tunes done the original way. Which on the Sco record, I think, is called Torero, but we used to call it High and Dry. And there's a few other tunes, some which never made it into the Sco repertoire. But yeah, there's I think on my Bandcamp page, there's a bunch of stuff, and then on YouTube, too. Some of the YouTube stuff, I tried to collect it all under one thing, and it's just called the Avi B3. So
yeah. I've checked that out on YouTube, man. Yeah, and listeners out there, whoever is listening. You know, I don't know if you've ever listened to this podcast, Avi, but sometimes I feel like I'm talking to myself because I don't really know how many people are listening. I've never tried to track it.
Yeah. I didn't know you did a podcast until I think we were hanging out and you told me, or maybe I just stumbled it on my own. I can't remember.
Tell more people. I don't know.
But the amazing thing to me is that you have time to do a podcast on top of all the other stuff you're doing. You're kind of an inspiration, I think, for work ethic. And
I just get bored on the road. It gives me something to do. You know, it's fun. I like to capture things and work on it. But so, man, you want to play a little something?
Sure.
Talk more about whatever else you want to talk about.
Yeah. I don't know. What should we play?
Anything you play. I'll join in and just kick something off.
Actually, I'll play a different guitar for this.
Just take your time, man.
You know, this tune, it's on the last Sco record. It's called the Al Green song.
I don't know it, no.
Yeah, it's pretty easy. But this is one of those tunes that was originally my tune that Chitty Jam Band would do, and that Sco sort of took my bridge, or the very beginning of my bridge, I guess, and then put a new bridge on it, which I think was a big improvement. But it's sort of the key shift at the bridge point is the same as what I had, but then he took it and made it musically better. So the main part is just C sharp minor to E major.
Okay.
A major to like E with a G sharp in the bass, and then F sharp minor. So it's C major 7. C minor. C major. 2-5 starting on E minor. 3 times. To the main group. Actually, we can just sit on that sit on the C sharp. Mm-hmm. vintage theme.
Nice tune.
Yeah, yeah. That's the Al Green song, so, you know, it has that.
Yeah, I get that. Totally, man. Yeah. What do you, on your right hand playing funk stuff, you, how do you hold your pick? Is it just thumb and index, right? Or two fingers?
No, I use, it's, I don't know where this came from, but I hold it with three fingers when I play rhythm, and then two fingers when I play single notes, so it's a little bit of a shift. At this point, I don't really think about it, but
you know, we're exactly the opposite. Because sometimes I'll hold it with
It's like that, and it, for me, it works well. I don't know. I guess because of the angle or something, or maybe I can just grip the pick better, and it doesn't fly out of my hands when I'm playing fast tempos. But then I've never gotten comfortable playing like that. Doing single notes, even though I think that might be the perhaps the George Benson way of picking.
Right, that's backwards. I don't think that's great for rhythm playing, though.
This way?
No.
Yeah, for me it works. And you know what's funny is I see like a lot of singer-songwriters who just strum playing acoustic guitar playing in the same way. So I don't know what that says, but there's something about it that maybe, I don't know.
Maybe
but
it's a
for me, it feels
it's like
right. I mean, I can play rhythm.
Match grip for a drummer, you know, it's the same thing.
Yeah, I don't know
if I was going to go, let's see, let me think of something. You just kind of improvise over it.
I feel like I don't have that stuff in my vocabulary.
Oh,
I love it.
You definitely do.
I'm just trying to find something.
Yeah, it sounds great.
that little thing where, that's something Sko showed me that maybe other guitar players know about, but I didn't.
Sounds like a keyboard thing.
Yeah. But it's really cool. It's where you keep the top note constant, mm-hmm. and then you shift the others chromatically. So like, and usually it's the way you showed it to me, it's a, kind of a stacked fourth voicing. Mm-hmm. So like,
yeah,
it doesn't work for all combo. Well, I guess sort of does. I mean,
it's kind of like this thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a similar concept. So like, if you're playing in a, you know, like a, if we're in G. Because you're keeping one note constant, and that's in the key, so you always leave that top note in this, if we're playing Dorian, you know.
Nice.
Anyway, you get the idea that the top note stays in the key, but then you can do almost whatever you want with the other notes, and because there's a consonant note, it's somehow okay.
It holds it together.
Exactly.
It approves it for ears.
So that was one of those cool chord voicing concepts that I picked up from Sko along the way. You know, everyone focuses on Sko's soloing, but equally amazing to me is his chording. I just love his comping and his chord voicings and his, it's just really unique.
Mm-hmm. He is a very unique guitar player. Yeah. I know when he... I had him on this podcast, and he came over that day. And when I was asking him about the, you know, all this.
Oh yeah, right. Yeah,
all that stuff. That's all the crazy. He said, "Yeah, it's like, you know, I was making it sound like an old singer."
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I was like. Nobody does that. I thought it came from just a mistake. Like, you know, his guitar wasn't set up right, or the string was too close to the edge. It kept happening, and then he just worked with it.
Man, you know, it's funny, that video you sent me of Sko, like the VH1 video for, if you can even fathom this, not even MTV has music anymore. VH1 used to show jazz video. John Scofield actually had a jazz video.
Yeah.
And he's like, where was it, in Chinatown or someplace?
Yeah, near here, down around on Canal Street. He's walking around. It's an awesome video because it's so 80s. He's got that
the Miami
blue,
Vice thing.
Yeah, Miami Vice jacket and... it actually, in some ways it hasn't changed much except for people's fashions, but you know, there people are selling cheap watches and all that stuff. It's that area of Canal. But I don't know if you told me about this or if I saw it or heard it from someone else, but that tune, I think it's called Protocol. Someone was asking, you know, what scale you play over this sort of chromatic-y, somewhat atonal bass line. And Sko said, well, you play the bass line, I'm going to solo, and you tell me when I hit a wrong note.
Yeah, it was on my podcast. Yeah, oh, okay, I asked him. Yeah. I'm just playing this and that. And he's like, it's just G. I go, yeah, but he said, it's just modal. And I go, but that's not modal, man.
Yeah.
It's not modal.
Was that on your podcast where I heard? Yeah. Yeah, that's so cool.
Yeah, I got him to play over it, and he's just, great player.
And someone else was asking me, not to talk about Sko over and over, but
sure,
that's
man,
right.
You talk about whatever you want.
Someone was asking me the other day if Sko's kind of a gearhead and into pedals and all that. I'm like, not really, you know. He's not that wedded to stuff, and I feel like, especially when Uber Jam was really developing, he was getting new pedals. A lot of times, I feel like he almost didn't know what they did, but he's such an amazing improviser that he steps on it and it does something and he responds to it in a cool way and figures out how to adapt to whatever that pedal is doing.
Yeah.
And he's so quick with it. And he, although at this point he's really developed something with that boomerang where he plays a line and then it seamlessly goes back. And you hear that on the track Uber Jam. And on other tracks too, but I'm amazed by it. He's really got that dialed in.
Did I tell you about the, I know I told you this, because for those listening, I used to live next, down the street from Schofield in Katona, which is a kind of Westchester County, north of Manhattan. And right before I moved to the city, Schofield said, yeah, I'm cleaning out my studio and I'm getting rid of a bunch of shit. And I was like, well, what do you have? Oh, it's nothing you want, but I got like a box of pedals, man. I'm going to get rid of all this shit. I said, well, he goes, I was going to send them to Larry Golding's, you know, keyboard player. But, you know, you could come over and, like, get some stuff. I'll tell you what, I'll split it half. I'll give you half and I'll give Larry Golding. I said, great, man. Mm-hmm. So, like, a month later, we used to go to this diner and I said, hey, did you ever clean out your studio? Yeah, cleaned it out. And he goes, man, I just sent all those pedals to Larry. You know, there's nothing you wanted, man. It's, like, old shit. You don't want any of that stuff. And I'm thinking, what, like, vintage Ibanez chorus, old rat? I mean, who knows what was in the box? Like, we're guitar players, man. We could have split it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Not a keyboard player. Come on. Yeah. But anyway.
And also, you know, he shrunk his pedal board down to nothing for this last tour. So he's not super wedded to particular pieces of gear.
Yeah. I asked him if he had those old Sundown amplifiers. I think I don't know if he still has them.
Yeah, Liberty Elman bought one of those.
Did he?
I was talking about this guitar player, Liberty,
I got to check him out.
Found some guy in New Jersey selling it or something. Or maybe the guy who made them lives in New Jersey, I forget. But,
well,
they're unique with that light-up faceplate, so you always knew what amp it was. But Sko was the only one I knew who ever used those things.
Yeah. I mean, you see all those old videos, man. Those guys in the 80s are playing like, it's just a mishmash of amps, of whatever jazz festival, whatever they had. It was like a Fender Twin and a Roland Jazz Chorus with like whatever plugged into it. And they made a lot of music with that stuff and it sounded great.
It's funny how guitar technology goes through trends, like, you know, rack systems or JC120s that people later on kind of laugh at and think, God, what was I thinking? But then I wonder how we'll look back on this boutique pedal trend where, you know, there's all these overdrives that are kind of the same with very minor differences and we're all obsessing about it. Or just the fact that we're stringing together these huge pedal boards, you know, with all these cables that can short out and go wrong. And maybe in the future we'll be back to the rack or
back to the Rockman
floor, you know,
the Rockman amplifier.
Yeah,
right. I think we should stockpile up Rockmans now, man. It's gonna be like buying gold or something. Maybe not.
Yeah.
Well, do you want to talk about I didn't do this in the intro, but what is your degree? And you work like for an acoustic thing, like you're really brilliant with all that stuff.
Well, I don't know about brilliant.
Well, it's probably
utilitarian.
You have attuned ears to like acoustic. I'm sure you have better than average knowledge of acoustic frequencies and theories.
Yeah,
and
I mean, well, first of all, the technical term for what I do is either acoustical consultant or acoustical engineer. And it has nothing to do with being a sound person. So I don't mess with PAs.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I don't mix bands. I don't function as a studio engineer. Although I have done that a little bit in the past, but that's not related to the practice of acoustical consulting. Mostly what I do is look at architectural and mechanical drawings. Mechanical drawings being the ventilation system of a building, and write reports and do some calculations here and there and tell architects and mechanical engineers and developers what they need to change in their building to have a good acoustic environment. And acoustic environments are important for apartment buildings, office buildings, laboratories, schools. So all kinds of things that have nothing to do with music. Occasionally, acoustical consulting does have to do with music, like if you're doing a recording studio or a radio station or something like that. But the actual work that you do sort of almost has nothing to do with music. Like playing an instrument is a totally different part of your brain that gets activated, and it's, you know, it's physical and it's you're really using your ear in a different way. Whereas with acoustics, you could almost be stone deaf and still do acoustical consulting as long as you know what to look for in drawings and how to do some calculations. And then probably 10% of the time, I'm actually in a building with a sound level meter. And most of the time it has to do with either sound transmission between spaces. So, you know, how much do you hear your neighbor's TV, for example, or some sort of pump noise that's annoying people in a building. So it's a lot of noise control. And then also room acoustics, so how reverberant a room is. But you'll notice here, you know, I have my small home studio set up with these speakers and everything, and I have zero acoustical treatment. It's just a bare room.
But
does
it ever drive you crazy when you're on the road in a hotel and you hear an elevator shaft or something?
Oh, yeah. So all these things, they can really be annoying. And so it's an important practice, I think, just for human comfort. But again, it really has very little to do with music, although a lot of people in the acoustical world are also musicians. And part of it is just like, you know, you play an instrument, you get interested in sound in general, but either you're not good enough or you don't want to go into music full time. So you find another job that's kind of related to sound. And but yeah, that's my part-time work that I'm lucky at this point. I've been doing it for a long time, so I have a lot of flexibility. So I can go on tour, I can do gigs. Like today, I'm not obviously not at work. So
I hope you didn't take off work just to do this.
Well, kind of, but that's okay because I got the flexibility. And, you know, a lot of clients that I have no idea that I have this other life as a musician. Sometimes they'll hear about it from someone else or they'll Google me for some reason. And then they see that everything that comes up has nothing to do with acoustics and it's me on stage with a guitar or something. So, but it's been good. You know, it can be pretty dry work and a little bit repetitive. But on the other hand, it's a job and it's income. And
maybe it makes you appreciate the music part more, actually.
It kind of does. And it also, I feel like I haven't had to scramble as much as other musicians and take weddings. And not that weddings are bad, but you know what I mean. It's not most musicians set out to not do that kind of work and play some sort of original music or play in front of appreciative audiences. And so I don't have to take every gig that gets offered to me, which is nice. You know, I can be a little more choosy. Although it so happens that everything I do these days I really enjoy. So I don't even seem to get offered things that I don't want to do.
That's cool, man. Seems
so
like
that's
you're
acoustic.
In a good...
But I studied that in graduate school, but I didn't study that in undergraduate. I studied Latin American studies, which has nothing to do with anything I do now. Except for I learned how to speak Portuguese, and occasionally I speak Portuguese.
Occasionally it'd be useful, yeah.
Yeah, occasionally it's useful. But you know what? I heard your interview with Jude on Jude's podcast, No Guitar is Safe, and you were talking about MI.
Mm-hmm.
And part of me has often wondered, man, what would it have been like if I had gone to music school? And I know I'd be a better player than I am now. Damn.
Man, I think you're a great player. And for what it's worth, I don't know. Maybe, I don't know what you consider. You're definitely not lacking anything, but I think originality is not taught in a place like that. That, you know, because you're influenced by a lot of people.
Yeah,
around,
you know. And maybe my personality wouldn't have been strong enough to find my own voice or keep my own voice in a music school. I feel like I've always been insecure, especially about jazz, but just guitar in general. I've been pretty insecure about whether I'm good enough. That's the reason I didn't go to music school. Actually, it's a funny story. Pat Metheny had a big influence on me. I love Pat Metheny like most guitar players, and he was coming out just at the time when I was really getting into guitar. I was like 15 or something. Mm-hmm. And I went and heard him. I think it was 1979 or 1980. And I was so blown away. And at the time, I guess I was 16, and he was probably 24 or something like that. So he was young enough to still seem like,
yeah, he was
kind of not that far away from me, but on a skill level,
it was Pat Metheny.
It was just like I saw no plausible path to get where he was from where I was, and it just seemed like the gulf was so huge that I thought, you know, forget it. Like if I can't be somehow on that level or at least comparable, I'm just not cut out for it. I'm not going to go into music. And so that was part of my college planning process. It's like, well, I can't be like Pat Metheny, so I'll just study something else. But then the weird thing is there's this video that came out of Pat Metheny playing with Gary Burton, and I think Mick Goodrick is in the band. And Pat Metheny's probably like 19 or something,
wow.
really young. And he sounds like he's 19. If I had heard that video, I probably would have made
different
decisions.
You might have had a different career
because
trajectory.
He just seemed like this untouchable guitar god, and I was a mere mortal. But he sounds way more mortal in this video.
Well, I think you've
done
pretty well
for
yourself.
But he sounds young and a little clunky, and it's just not the same fluidity.
He hadn't figured out how to put the toothbrush in the back of his. You've seen that, right? He puts the toothbrush in the bridge. If you look at any old Pat Metheny, there's a toothbrush jammed in the bridge.
What, to keep it from resonating?
I guess.
Or something?
I mean, there's numerous other objects you could have chosen, but it's a crusty toothbrush shoved in there.
Maybe he was just oral hygiene conscious and between songs
with
brushes teeth.
Check out the old Metheny, you know, I was talking to Mark Egan. He was on my podcast, and he was in the original Metheny band.
Yeah.
I didn't tell him this. I didn't want to say it. But one day I was somewhere, and I heard Bruce Hornsby, and I was like, wow, man, that's really cool. And the guitar solo came up, and I was like, wow, man, that's a great guitar solo. What an interesting solo. And it was contemporary and sort of popish. Like, who is that? It's really hip sounding guitarist, you know, who is that? And I look at the credits and it's Pat Metheny. And I thought, it doesn't sound like Pat Metheny, the tone. It's like he must have looked at his tone knob and went, wonder what this thing does, and turned it up.
Yeah.
And played the solo and then said, well, I'll just turn it back down to zero.
I wonder if it was one of those things where he was in the same studio complex and showed up and was like, oh, can you play a solo? I don't have my guitar, but, you know, they gave him a guitar. I wonder if it was
that. I don't know, but it sounded great.
You know, there's another Pat Metheny video. I think David Byrne used to have a music show or something. I think because David Byrne, is it the same?
Didn't he host
sessions at...
Sessions at West 54th,
yeah,
sure.
The Pat Metheny group is on it, and they're doing this kind of real rock, almost new wave techno tune, and it sounds great. And Pat Metheny's playing that Roland thing, but it's like set to a kind of a surf guitar sound. Fantastic. It's cool to hear other guitar players with a tone that's totally different from what you normally associate with.
Well, is there anything else you want to talk about, man? You want to?
I don't know. I mean, I'd like to talk more about you.
No, this is about you.
I don't know. We've covered a bunch of stuff.
I mean, I'm going to play some tracks from your record, Clean Slate. And
yeah,
I'll
right.
talk about that in the intro.
Yeah, that was kind of a homemade record in a way. It's not, even the stuff that kind of sounds like it's a band, it's not really a band playing. It was all pieced together. Sometimes the drums were the last thing to go on. It was very homemade. You know, it took a lot of effort, but still it wasn't. It wasn't like getting a bunch of people together and showing them the tunes. And I think on one song I had three different drummers play. It was kind of like Steely Dan, where they get everyone,
Peter Gabriel,
corral all the studio people and have them do solos and decide which one's the best. Yeah. This was like, it's. I think there's some cool stuff on that record. Maybe jam on this tune. It's just kind of a. Is it minor blues? I guess so. Do you know this guitar? Can we play other people's music? Is that cool?
Yeah. Play whatever.
I mean, I think the guy's long dead. And no one
I don't know. I don't think there's enough people listening to sue me. So,
this guy Ivan Boogaloo Joe Jones. You know, he was like a soul jazz guy. But he has this song called "Black Whip," and I think you'll pick it. It's in E flat, and it's. I guess it's a minor blues, but it has this cool riff. So 1, 2, 3. Thank you. Something
all right,
like that.
I got it. Yeah. Next time I'll have it for sure.
Not really the right guitar to play this on, but
that
whatever.
Sounds great, man. Yeah. All right, Avi. Well, thank you, man, for doing
thanks,
this.
Thanks, Shane. It's a pleasure.
Yeah,
I sound great. Let's go get some lunch.
Let's do it. We're in Chinatown. It's probably good Chinese food.
Yeah.
Somebody told me anyway.
Cool, man.
Thanks.
All right, guys, gals, thank you so much for listening. If you haven't already, please subscribe. And I've also got many other episodes. If you've heard the spiel before, just you can stop now. But yeah, I've got a lot of other people on my past episodes. Got John Scofield, who we talked about at length on this episode. And got Warren DeMartini and Mike Stern and John Leventhal and John Harrington for guitar players. We've also got drummers, bass players, George Porter Jr., Johnny Vidakovich. Check them out. See you next time.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of plan investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.